Hi there, you're very welcome to Triton Lake Perform. My name is Connor Smith, the founder and CEO of Triton Lake, a marketplace that efficiently connects sophisticated investment allocators with relevant private market opportunities. In 2021, Triton Lake became the title sponsor of the Ireland men's and women's rugby sevens teams. This podcast explores the intersections of sport and business, looking at what both worlds can learn from each other and what are the key parts to the puzzle of high performance. For this episode, we're delighted to welcome Stuart Lancaster, senior coach at Leinster Rugby. Leinster narrowly missed out in a fifth Champions Cup title last weekend in Marseille. Stuart, welcome back, commiserations, and thanks very much for taking the time to chat today.
No problem, Connor. Great to be here.
Maybe to set the scene a little bit before we dive into Leinster and everything else, give us a little bit of background to Stuart's upbringing and what took you through England and I guess eventually to Leinster, just to give a flavour for that.
Yeah, so I was born and bred in Cumbria in the Lake District, North of England, border Scotland. My mum's Scottish, my dad an English dairy farmer. So formative years very much on the farm. And then I went to a boarding school on the west coast of Cumbria when I was 10 years old. So did that for 8 years. Went to university in Leeds and became a PE teacher. So I taught PE in a secondary school called Kethorpe High School until the year 2000, actually. The game of rugby went professional in 95, so I started getting paid to play. But ultimately, it was an injury that sort of curtailed my career. But at the same time, an academy role came up, which allowed me then to leave teaching and go into coaching full-time, I guess. So I did that for 5 years, till 2005, and then took over as head coach of the Leeds team that I was formerly a player of. Did that for 2 years, and then the RFU approached me about head of elite player development. So basically, running all the academies in England and the international age grade teams and coaching England Saxons. Martin Johnson resigned 2011. I got the interim job of England for that Six Nations. Things went well. Got the full-time job, did that for 4 years. Winning a lot more than we lost, fortunately. But the key game that we needed to win was Wales game in the World Cup, and we lost that 28-25. And ultimately, that cost me my job with England. And there was a bit of a void at that point as I worked out what to do next, travelled the world a bit, learnt lessons from other organisations, shared lessons that I'd learned. And then Leo Cullen out of the blue rang me in September 2016 to say would like to join Leinster. And here I am six years later, nearly.
And the rest is history, as they say. And when you think about that, I guess if we just rewind a small bit, the transition from the teaching into the coaching aspect, as a player, did you know that coaching was something you wanted to do? I mean, teaching feels a lot like coaching to, you know, it's in a different sphere, obviously, but it's connected. Was that relaying of skills part of a passion that you have?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I was certainly happy being a teacher at the time. And yes, I was a rugby player, but I was never a full-time rugby player. So it was always, you know, sat in the background behind the career, really, you know, Tuesday, Thursday, play Saturday. So I'd always consider myself a teacher and then a coach, not a professional rugby player. So then the natural evolution, you know, to go from teaching 11 to 16-year-olds a multitude of different sports to trying to set up an academy system and develop the very best 14 to 18-year-olds to be professional rugby players wasn't seamless, but it was definitely aided and abetted by the teaching career for sure. And the teaching definitely gave me a passion for helping people improve, working in teams, motivating people and sharing what I'd learned. And that was definitely a big connection between the teaching and the coaching careers.
Makes sense. In terms of the role with Leinster, maybe describe that and the transition, I suppose. I know there was a gap in the middle, but from the English setup, the RFU setup, and what you walked into in Leinster, was there, I mean, obviously you put a lot of work into the elite side of the English game, which fed up into the role that you had at the top. Were you walking into something that needed more work from that perspective with Leinster, or do you feel it had gone some of the way there and you were kind of adding to it?
Yeah, no, it was a very very different role, really. The England job was, by the time, you know, I was the head coach, was essentially like a director of rugby role, but of a national team. So, you know, you're in charge of obviously the national team, but I saw it as my responsibility to work with the age grade teams and try and create this connected player development system. So there's only 10 games when you're an international coach. So a lot of the time was not coaching, actually. It was on leadership and managerial tasks, really, you know, like within the union, pulling together a vision, trying to align people towards the vision, managing the club-country relationship, managing the media, managing the commercial partners, managing the board and the people above me. You know, so a lot of that type of stuff. And then when I came to Leinster, a lot of that was in place. So obviously club land, it was day in, day out, week in, week out, so no breaks. Club rugby, Leo and Guy were at the top of the organisation. So we had a general manager and Leo's role, which effectively is, like a director of rugby role. And I came in as the head coach. So the job for me became a lot more about hands-on, on-the-grass coaching than it probably ever was with England. And you know, when you relay it back to my teaching career, that's essentially what I did Monday to Friday, 40-odd weeks of the year. You know, plan, do, review, badminton lesson, plan, do, review, basketball, plan, do, review, hockey, plan, do, review, football, plan, do, review, gymnastics, you know, Tuesday next. So I was back doing really, I guess, what I started doing, which was really enjoyable on the back of, obviously, the pressure of being in charge of everything with England.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things I was going to ask you was to rate your experience as a player in comparison to your time as a coach. And I'm guessing that that kind of hands-on coaching role is a lot more aligned with that than the RFU role.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that said, I would never turn around and regret taking the role at the RFU or going through the stages in my career that I've gone through, because it's given me a broad spectrum of skills and understanding of different ways to develop yourself as a leader, as a coach, and as a manager. You know, if you think about it, teaching is hands-on, then the academy manager's role, leadership and management responsibilities, coaching the senior team at Leeds, you know, more pressure in terms of bigger picture stuff, back to the RFU with managing 14 academies throughout the country of England, you know. So there's lots of different skills that I picked up along the way to give me a broad understanding of lots of areas. So I don't regret any of the paths I've taken. I think one of the things that's helped me as well is that I was fortunate. I had three really good mentors who pushed me and developed me in the right direction and gave me opportunities. And to be fair, I pushed the door open on coach development, leadership development and managerial development on courses and opportunities that allowed me to grow as well. So, and once those doors were open, then the study of other sports and business and the link between business and sport and the great leadership books out there, you know, I was very much immersed in that in my mid-30s.
Okay.
Or still am, really.
No, yeah. In terms of your experience as a player, did any of them contribute to your coaching style, would you say? Any coaches that you had, or do you think most of that coaching stuff came after the playing?
No, I think, again, I go back to the point. So my playing career was Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. It wasn't a full-time. Like, the influence of the coaches, yes, they had an influence on my mindset, but not to the same extent that teaching did, or the academy role, or the support of those three mentors, you know. So I gravitated, you know, into leadership positions in teams, but again, it was very much amateurism building into part-time and full-time professionalism in the mid to late 90s. So it's not like you would see me as a professional rugby player now.
No. It sounds like the three mentors you alluded to are a key part, but other influences on your coaching career as you progressed, anyone that stood out?
No, I'd say, well, everyone really. Everyone I've worked with. Phil Davies would be the first one at Leeds. My school teacher, Tony Rolt, was a big influence on shaping my mindset. The guys who taught me how to teach, so Malcolm Butterworth, Merv Beck, these sorts of people, Bernie White at university, they were excellent sort of in terms of growing my understanding of teaching. But then once you're into it and you're off and running, you know, you're meeting and you're seeing other coaches coach, you get invited on Six Nations Coaching Conference, or you go and shadow England Saxons on a tour and you're watching, you know, all sorts of different coaches coach. So it's then about picking up little pieces from many people. But the three mentors I've come back to would be the biggest influence. So Kevin Barron, head of coach development, pushed me on the courses. Bill Bezick, the sports psychologist, helped me with the mindset and the attitude of the elite athlete. And Brian Ashton, the technical and tactical coach, who was in charge of the academies at the time, his vision for the game and his ability to create attacking teams that saw space and played to space. You know, those three were the keys.
Okay. How would you describe your coaching style, I guess, if you had to?
Pretty varied, I'd say. I'd like to think, you know, sometimes I'm directive, sometimes I'm asking questions. Sometimes I'm showing examples from a video from a different sport. Sometimes I'm working hard on session design and session content. So I try and work on the three areas, you know, the technical and tactical development of the players, the mental aspect of developing the players with the right mindset, the right attitude, the right competitive spirit, and then the physical attributes that you need to play at the highest level. Whilst I'm not in charge of the gym program, I make sure that the players who train at Leinster are super fit and can play the game at the pace and tempo we want to play with. Because, you know, the genetic profile of players in Ireland is not the same as the Southern Hemisphere, for example. You know, we don't have that profile. So we're never going to have the power that sometimes some of the other teams will have. So therefore, we need to have the pace, skill and finesse, really. That's the idea. And so try and flip between all these different styles. Someone said to me, it's a bit like going to the golf course and picking the right club at the right time. And I think that's the art of good leadership and good coaching.
Yeah, a good analogy. In terms of rugby culture, I mean, you've touched on it, but you've spanned right across from the amateur to the amateur slowly turning professional to the what now is a fully professional game. How have you seen culture evolve over that period of time?
I mean, I coached my son's under six team. I've coached women's rugby, university rugby, under 16s rugby. As you say, the amateurs and professionalism, club and country. I would say when I first started playing, we played for the enjoyment and for the love of the sport. We weren't getting paid. The game went through this transitional period of obviously professionalism. But I'd like to think that if you came into a Leinster environment, you'd see enjoyment, you'd see good people working hard for a common goal. You'd see a sense of brotherhood and comradeship, and you'd see a strong identity. So all the things I guess I grew up on, the cultural things that were there in the amateur era, are very present in Leinster now. It's a bit more challenging internationally because obviously you get the players for less time. They come from competing clubs. They're all vying to start for their country. So that presents a challenge. And obviously pressure that's now on the young player is different from the pressure that was on young players when I was, you know, in my mid-20s. So, you know, we're asking them to play in front of obviously 80,000 people in a stadium, but with 10 million people watching and judging you in every moment and ranking you on a score of 1 to 10 in 8 different national newspapers. So it's serious pressure. And that does affect the culture, I think, a little bit. And also so does the money that's involved. You know what I mean? That's clearly a fact as well, but not as much as you'd think, really. I think the old-fashioned values that I grew up in are very much prevalent here at Leinster.
Good. And if you think about culture at the international level again, and going back to England for a moment, you were credited, I guess, with overhauling the culture of that team through a couple of decisions in terms of including or not including players. Culture clearly is an important part of the group. And as you're looking at potential new players coming in, how do you measure that they're going to be a fit for the environment? You know, is that a key part of the recruitment process, trying to understand if they're going to fit into the jigsaw, or how do you evaluate that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the recruitment decision or the selection decision. You know, often, you know, with England, you're not recruiting, you're selecting.
Yeah.
Jim Collins wrote his book, Good to Great, isn't he? Get the right people on the bus, then drive it somewhere great. So getting good people definitely helps. So both within your management team and within your coaching, within your playing group as well. So the cultural development from 2011 to 2015 wasn't just based on selection. It was based on changing the environment, trying to reconnect with the grassroots rugby fans, trying to make sure that we won games, but won them in the right way, in a respectful way. And we tried to play good rugby. I think all those little things added up to a change in perception of the team, and I think the crowd got behind them. And that's why I guess the fall from the 2015 World Cup was so big, because I think a lot of people really believed in what the team were doing, and it was great after that to see them go on and achieve success, albeit they didn't win the World Cup, you know, to achieve the World Cup final in 2019. So once you've got a good environment or culture, whichever you want to call it, you definitely want to guard it at all costs, and you've got to really be smart about when you release people from the top end of your group, and when you bring younger, talented players in, but also they need to make sure they're a good cultural fit for what you've created within the environment, because it doesn't take long under pressure for bad apples, or bad fits to rot the barrel a bit, you know. So it's, and how do you do that? Well, you do your homework. You find, you ask good questions, you know, you ask people who know the player and or know the person that you're trying to bring in management team. You interview them, or whichever way you do it, you know, you make sure you've done your homework.
And if you're if it's a leader, I guess, on the pitch or even in the management team, in the backroom staff, are there other key characteristics that you look for?
Yeah, definitely. I think there are people in rugby teams, both in management teams, in the management team and also in the playing group, who are doers, you know, who are there to, they just want to help. They want to help the team function. They want to be effective on the field. They're not necessarily the leaders of the team or the leaders in the management team. They have to have particular qualities that make them stand out as a leader. One is having a point of view. Two is having credibility. Three is always being able to think and plan ahead. And four is being honest. Five is having integrity. Six is being a good communicator. Seven is being calm under pressure. Eight is, you know, inspiring people with their actions and their words, you know, being a great connector of people. So there's a whole list of characteristics that good leaders need. And sometimes they just grow and evolve in your organization. And sometimes you can spot them a mile away and you bring them in and you get involved with them as soon as you can. One of the challenges is, from a playing point of view, is that you might be a great leader, but you're still trying to develop your playing credibility to get in the team. Do you know what I mean? So that often means that the best leaders, who are the youngest players sometimes, they take a while to rise to the top because of the nature of selection and their credibility as a player coming first.
Maybe we'll touch a little bit on success and defeat without spending too much time on specific events. But obviously you've experienced a great deal of success in your various roles, as well as some disappointing days along the way. How does your approach to a tournament or competition differ after a win or a loss? And, you know, I suppose this week is a good example of that, coming from last weekend, going into another important game here. How do you get the mindset right for that?
Yeah, I'll talk about my own individual mindset first, and then I'll try and talk about how I try and shape the mindset of the others on the back of my mindset. Because if you can't sort yourself out first, then you're not going to lead other people. So, you know, I think I've tried to maintain an even keel in what's a pretty choppy environment. You know, rugby's a sport where there's not many sports like it, where the subjectivity and the judgment of a referee can ultimately influence the outcome more so than any other sport I know. You know, so like the grey areas within the sport, the bounce of a ball is the classic quote, is definitely a factor in rugby, you know, and that definitely has a bearing on the outcome. So it puts you in a very uncomfortable position when you are not in control of the outcome. And you are with any other sport, you know, you're giving the players responsibility to go and play, and ultimately you take the responsibility if they win or if they lose. But in rugby, more so than, say, soccer or cricket or even American football, where there's multiple camera angles and six referees, you know, it's a lot more, there's a lot more grey. So sometimes I question my sanity about the sport I've chosen to coach in. But I've learned to, if you imagine like a big wave, you know, the dip is the defeat and the top, the peak is the victory. It's trying to maintain an even keel through those dips and peaks, but also making sure you enjoy the moments when you win. You enjoy the moments when you succeed. You enjoy the moments when a young player comes through and achieves success. You enjoy when, you know, you win a game that you maybe weren't destined to win, or all your internationals away and you win a URC game in, you know, in the Aviva against Munster, which was one of the great victories we had this season with our lads who weren't internationals. So you enjoy those moments. You enjoy the atmosphere in the changing room. You enjoy the company of the people you've worked with all year. But then when it goes the other way, you know, the disappointment of defeat is so acute. You know, you need to protect yourself a little bit and those around you by understanding that, you know, it's not just on you. Like, I definitely beat myself up after the World Cup in 2015. And, you know, it was very tough, lonely existence on my own. I felt England went on to become successful. I decided to go to South Africa, New Zealand and Australia. And I put a positive slant on it, but the reality was, I spent a lot of time in planes on my own and hotels on my own and just thinking about what if.
And you felt the coach in that role, you felt you had the accountability for that.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. I was the leader. Yeah. I mean, I was in charge, you know, it was on my watch. You know, I think it would have been a failure of leadership if I turned around and abdicated responsibility or blamed someone else.
Yeah.
So, and I wore it, you know, because I cared about the environment, I cared about the people, cared about doing a good job for the country. So, you know, it's acute, and it sort of, it gives you a bit of a coat of armor for the next time around, but it doesn't protect you permanently. And I spoke to the players this week about, you know, the defeat in the Champions Cup final, and a coach said to me once, it's like a scar that you have that never truly heals, but one thing that does help it heal is winning the next game and the next game and the next game. The black and white nature of sport means that we might lose this weekend, or we might lose next weekend, semi-final or the final. And that's like putting salt in the wound, you know, rather than ointment. Yeah. So you just work hard. You know, you go back to rolling your sleeves up, you know, trying to help and inspire the group, trying to re-motivate, trying to explain away the defeat with things they can tangibly do to improve. You try and get from what was the problem to what's the solution next time. And you try and give examples from, I don't know, other sports or business where people have succeeded after failure, and how you use failure as a tool to re-motivate and re-energize the playing group. But it's tough. You know, you've got to go through that grief cycle of defeat, but you've got to get out of it quick because there's another game coming around the corner. And we have a phrase, sumo, shut up, move on. And it's a discipline as well. You know, that ability to shut up and move on and realize that whilst you feel that everyone out there is judging you and watching you, most people, even if they're passionate supporters, have moved on. But that doesn't make it easier to take, you know, I have to be honest.
No, 100%. You touched on the using business as an example set, I guess, to play back to sport. And, you know, obviously it's something we firmly believe in. There's lots of parallels between elite sports and high-performing business. And outside of rugby, you yourself do have your leadership, coaching and management side of things. Maybe give us a sense of that and how where the learnings in your mind are between the two.
Well, I would say they are significant. I mean, I've been lucky in that I've worked or read books. You know, I'm very interested in what makes the great company successful and why. And where I can, I will try and meet and connect with people who are in leadership positions in the big organisations. And often you get asked to talk about the lessons from sport that are related to business. The feedback has always been very positive because it's always been so relevant. You know, the cutthroat nature of the business world, the managing of people, the managing of teams, they're getting the best out of people to perform and execute at the highest level on a consistent basis. The building of a long-term high-performing culture, how to create diversity in a team, how to bring young talent through, how to develop leadership. You know, all these things that you do in rugby, you do in sport, in business. So, yeah, I found there's a natural parallel. And, you know, I think I've got 18,000 connections on LinkedIn now because I share everything I've learned from sport or business or a book I've read on there for free so people can just learn and grow themselves. And that's the teacher in me. You know, that's the teacher in me wanting to share and pass on what I've learned. So you can't actually see my flat here, but there's probably about 60 books sat over there. So I would always be trying to develop myself. And, you know, like I say, I'm lucky I've met like a Jim Collins. So I've met him and I've been able to pick his brains. Kevin Murray wrote the book, Communicate to Inspire, Language of Leaders. You know, I know him. There's great leadership books of people that have died that I've read that I thought, you know, has had a big impact on me. So Bill Walsh, the American football coach, John Wooden, the basketball coach, and they're all related to business.
And when you, just out of curiosity, do you read every day? Do you go to, after you get back from training, take a couple of hours and read a few chapters?
I'm pretty, obviously there's a fair amount of like cutting of game film and preparing for meetings and reviewing training. I guess you might call it an advantage in terms of my own development, but it's not an advantage if you're married. Like I live in Dublin on my own and my wife lives in Leeds. My two kids are just finishing university now. So hopefully we will live together, you know, in the next year or so. But it means I've got a lot of time on my own in the evenings. I don't have that extra sort of challenge of family. I've decided not to have a TV here in my little flat. So I would generally try and do something constructive. And it might be like I was pulling together a little movie for the players to help them through the defeat, which was centered around the Boston Celtics and the LA Lakers, the challenges they had against each other during the mid-80s. And just to sort of show how the LA Lakers turned it around, having lost in the World Series in 84. So things like that I would often do in an evening. And don't get me wrong, you know, I do understand the need to unwind and switch off from work as well. So, you know, clearly you're watching Netflix or whatever, but you, generally I try and be productive with my time. And if I'm not working, I'm connecting back home with family. Or I'm trying not to burn the candle at both ends. I'm trying to do a good job by planning my sessions well, getting to bed early and getting
recharging
up and getting
the batteries.
To the gym and doing, yeah, you know, the personal stuff well.
Yeah. Maybe to we'll circle back before we finish up just to Leinster again. Tell us a little bit about the dynamic between you and Leo, I guess, in terms of the management of the team. How does that work? And do you think that dynamic between both of you is partly what's contributed to the success over the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, we're very similar in personality, I think. We're both quite detail orientated. We'd see integrity as an important value. We're both trusting, and I think we trust each other, and I think we communicate well together. I think he's very, very good at the big picture stuff. He's very good at dealing with multiple stakeholders. He's very good and detail orientated in his planning, and with guys to be as well. So a lot of that managerial stuff that I did with England, I don't have to concentrate on. So, and I can probably fill in the gaps for him on the coaching side of things. Now, if someone said to me, you've got to go back into a role like Leo's doing now, could you do it? Probably could, but do I want to do it?
Yeah.
No, probably not.
Yeah.
So I think that, yeah, it is a really good fit, you know, between the two of us. I think we cover a lot of the bases that you need. For one person to do both jobs, I think that's very difficult.
It's difficult today. And I think, you know, the obviously, if you're having to do all of those bits as well, you don't have time to get your own mindset fine-tuned to deliver the coaching aspect as effectively as you would if that's the core of it. Yeah,
exactly. And I think your relationship a little bit, you know, you distance yourself from the players because you're too busy doing like X number of jobs.
Yeah.
So I do think, you know, I've got a close relationship with all the players, you know, which I think is really important to me, particularly again on the back of the England experience where perhaps, you know, I could have been, it was hard, you know, because of the challenges of selection and making the decisions about are you playing, are you not playing. But I definitely feel, you know, I've coached these lads for 6 years now. I've watched them grow from 24 years old to 30 years old. And, you know, your Gary Ringroses, your Josh Van der Fleers, your Robbie Henshaws, you know, they've grown into great, great role models and great, great young men. And that's not including Johnny, who's 30 when I arrived, he's 36 now.
Yeah. I mean, what do you see? If that's the last 6 years, how do the next few years look like? Do you see? How do you continue moving this organization forward from where they are today?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, I think a lot about my own personal position. You know, how long is too long in an organization? And if I ever get the sense that the message is becoming stale or the sessions are getting repetitive and sort of rolling their eyes like we've done this before and here we go again, I'll be out the door really. But I don't get that sense at the moment. I still think there's a lot of growth in the team. I think the team's only going to get better. If I'm being honest, I think looking at the age profile, the two signings that we've made for next year, I think we'll have a better team next year, which is great. I think the evolution of the coaching team with Felipe Contepomi leaving will be enhanced by a new coach coming in. You know, not that they'll be better than Felipe, just more it's going to be different, which I think is probably needed at the time. So I think Leinster are in a good place. You know, I really do, irrespective if Leo and I are here and Guys 3 moves on or whoever. I do think Leinster are in a good place, and it's going to take something dramatically bad to change it off that course, really. For my own personal development, you know, I'm 52 now, so I think a lot about next steps, and I'm still young enough, obviously, for me to coach for at least another 15 years or so. You know, I'm not in a hurry to retire, that's for sure. I'd like to coach other coaches and help develop them. I'd probably like some more experiences outside of the UK and Ireland, but always in the back of my mind is marrying that with my wife, my kids, my mum, you know, my family, my white extended family. And it's easy, you know, to be selfish and say, oh, well, I'm going to go and coach in New Zealand, but that's not much use to your children if they're going to stay in the UK or whatever. You know what I mean? So there's lots of other things that weigh in your mind, particularly when you've asked so much of them in the time you've had together anyway. You know, I started that England job in 2007, you know, if we go back to the start of the conversation, and that was traveling from Leeds to Twickenham, which is a four-hour journey. So I essentially lived away from home from 2007, and I've not really been back on a day-to-day basis. So
for any prolonged period of time.
I've missed big moments, but you know, we stay connected and we're still very close family. So I'm lucky in that regard, but you know, spending some time with my wife might not be a bad idea as well at some point.
Yeah, good. Well, Stuart, it's been really great to chat to you. I think we gained some very interesting insights into the workings of what's a hugely successful backroom team. We wish you every success for what's sure to be an exciting end to the season and starting this weekend in the quarter final. That's it for this episode of Triton Lake Perform. As always, thank you for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed our chat with Stuart, and we'll be back very soon with another episode.